Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph by myself, Catherine Whittaker, by David Law. I'm in London, David's in Birmingham. We are brought together by the cyberspace podcast universe, David, in a beautiful technological way.
A nirvana. Is that the right word?
Podcast Nirvana. Well, hello and welcome to Podcast Nirvana. You're using new equipment to record, David. So prior to hitting record today, David said the words to me, using the new equipment. So fingers crossed this records.
It looks like a little spaceship.
I mean, you might never be hearing this. Yeah. These golden words might be falling on deaf ears.
It's a bit scary looking. I've understood which the red button means record, I think. So if you're hearing this, it does.
If you're hearing this, all is well. If you're not, then it's like one of those sort of apocalypse videos that you make. If you're hearing this, it can only be bad news, except the reverse of that. I met up with some podcast comrades during my recent trip to Guernsey, David. The presenters, the guys from the cricket, the World Cricket Show podcast, which is a brilliant podcast if you're also interested in cricket. And honestly, when we started comparing and contrasting our recording techniques and equipment, there was so much nerdy excitement around the table. It was palpable.
Oh dear.
Yeah. No, it was great. It was great. So let's nerd out about some tennis, David.
Yeah.
That's what we're here for, weekly, daily during slams, nerding out about tennis. Lots has happened. The WTA Finals in Singapore has got underway. We're recording on Monday evening. We've had two full days of play. We're, of course, going to talk about that and the fact that I think the court is way too slow. But first, we are going to talk about Carl Edmund, David.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Carl Edmund because he's won an ATP title. He's defeated Guillaume Monfils in an absolute thriller of a final in Antwerp, 7-6 in the third. Did I just say that?
No, I don't think you did.
I didn't, no. All right.
Did
well,
happen,
I can't,
though.
I can't emphasise it enough. It went to a deciding set tiebreak, and that was brilliant. And boy, did he hold his nerve. I texted you at the time, and I said, I owe Carl Edmund a big apology because I was waiting for him to choke. I was. I knew how big it was for him, and I know what kind of a player Monfils is, and he was just looping it back, waiting for Kyle to miss, and he didn't. He didn't play conservatively either. He absolutely went for it, and he wrenched that title from Gael Monfils into his own hands. And goodness me, there was some emotional reaction from Edmund, wasn't there, on winning his first ATP
Did that surprise
title.
You?
It surprised me that he was so demonstrative about it. Yeah, I mean, I knew it didn't surprise me what it meant to him. I knew that was big. That was really, really big. And I feared for him a bit if he didn't win that, because as we've discussed, you know, the baggage builds up. And you look at the first time titleist on the tour this year, his name should be in there. His name absolutely should be in there. So yeah, I knew how big it was for him. I've never seen him be anywhere close to that demonstrative with any kind of emotion. I know it's something that Freddie Rosengrant's been trying to bring out of him on the court in a positive way, you know, a bit more fist pumping, a bit more just heart on the sleeve kind of stuff. But my goodness me, it was an outpouring, wasn't it? In the same sort of way, obviously very different emotions to Murray's tears on the court in Washington, just a sort of a release of everything, a release of absolutely everything that he's put in to get to that moment.
Probably closer to, I guess, to Murray, some of the scenes we've seen on court with him in the past. Although I can't remember too many times when he's won and been that emotional. Maybe after the Olympics the second time round, you know, when he beat Del Potro. But no, it was a surprise to me to see him like that, just because we haven't seen it. But it was so significant. It was so significant for him in his own career. It's become a recurring theme for us, talking about Kyle Edmund's progress, and yet this mountain still hadn't been scaled, this winning of a first title. And also, when you start to look at the significance of it in British tennis terms, because it just hasn't happened that British men have been winning titles, unless your name is Andy Murray. The last one to do it was Greg Rozetsky in 2005 in Newport on the grass. Henman last won his final title in 2003. It's 15 years ago. So it's significant in those terms. And I think it's just a major milestone for Edmund as he goes into 2019. He is basically about a year behind Tim Henman in just about every achievement Henman has had to that point, of reaching a first slam semi, getting to a career high ranking of number 14 in the world, and winning a first title. So it's a great achievement for Edmund in what has become a really excellent year of tennis for him.
Yeah. Yeah, and particularly as he's going to go into the start of next season. I mean, who knows? This season might not be over. There's still an outsider's outside chance that he gets to London, right? Less than an outsider's outside chance of being an alternate.
Yeah, I mean, he needs, because Del Potro's got this injury, the chances are he's not playing. So it does mean that if Edmund was to do what, to use the words Henman and Rozetsky again, those two players both won Paris, and I think would regard that as their biggest title victory. Great scenes back in 1998 when Rozetsky beat Sampras in straight sets in the final. Sampras was world number one at the time. That's 20 years ago, 1998. 15 years ago, Henman had an incredible run to the title. He beat Davidenko, he beat Gustavo Kuerten, he beat Sebastian Grosjean, he beat Roger Federer, he beat Andy Roddick, and then Andre Pavel in the final to win that title. That's basically what Edmund would have to do.
And then Andre Pavel in the final.
I know, well, it is a bit. Andre Pavel's a very good player, but still, I know what you mean.
I've worked with many great actors and Warwick Davis. It's like that line, isn't it?
That's harsh.
That was your delivery.
No,
he beat Andy Roddick. Roger Federer, and then he beat Andre Pavel.
Yeah, all right. I did sort of think at the end, should I mention Andre Pavel, who we beat in the final? Yes, I should. No disrespect to Andre intended, but yes, lofty names indeed that Henman beat that week, and that, yeah, Edmund's got to do something like that in orders, because he needs 1,000 points to make up, and that's what he would get if he won Paris. But he's got Vienna this week, so we'll see how he goes. It's not impossible.
Oh, it's a lot of tennis, isn't it?
It's unlikely. It's unlikely, really. But, you know, he's a durable lad, isn't he?
If he only gets in as an alternate, you know, it's not inconvenient for him, is he? He can stay at home, pop along to the O2 every day. I think you still get paid pretty handsomely just for hanging out.
Yeah, you get plenty of money. You know. But didn't he say that he wasn't actually 100% sure if he would take it if he did get it? Remember when Dimitrov got there and didn't play? 2014.
Yeah, but what possible disincentive could there be for him not to accept an alternate spot? I suppose he doesn't actually live in the UK anymore, does he? He lives in the Bahamas.
No, it's another week to go and, you know, put your feet up and get ready for the next year. But I'm sure
he can have a pretty sweet old time as an alternate at the old O2.
He would want to go, I'm sure, if he actually did go.
Yeah, of course he would. So. Yeah.
So anyway, well done, Kyle Edmund. Very good.
Well done, Kyle Edmund. His backhand down the line, by the way, was an absolute revelation. I know you do. Were you not able to watch the match?
No, actually,
because it wasn't on UK television.
Thank goodness you did see the match, because you watched it on Tennis TV, didn't you? And nobody else that I know, apart from you and student Matt, and obviously there are many people who watch Tennis TV, but, you know, my mum would have loved to have watched that match. She doesn't even know what Tennis TV is, you know?
It's a terrible shame that it wasn't on a UK broadcaster, a really terrible shame. I don't know enough about the nuances of rights deals to know, like, you know, why couldn't one of the UK broadcasters just bought the rights to the final, you know, almost on the day after... Because, you know, there's no other rights holder in this country to compete with.
Yeah,
you know,
it is a shame.
I would like to think someone tried, and for whatever reason it wasn't possible, because that is such an open goal missed, and it's another example of tennis not doing itself any favours. You know, that's a big opportunity to bring tennis to the attention of the masses outside of Wimbledon.
Yeah.
I'm sure his sponsors weren't too happy about it either.
No, well, I mean, and it's interesting that this morning all the news channels were all over it, because they picked up the little bit of highlights of him having won his first title, cried at the end. I mean, it is just one of those memorable moments, and everybody
wants
to know about it.
Yeah, it's great footage. Yeah, it's big, and especially for someone like Kyle Edmund, who has been difficult to get to know over the years, hasn't he? He's a very he's completely likable, but he's very sort of serious. He takes what he does very seriously, which is obviously deserving of respect, but in terms of getting to know the guy and feeling, you know, that he's letting us in, I don't think we've felt that way on many occasions over the few years of his career so far, but this was a massive leap in that direction. So yeah, thank goodness from a news perspective it was really picked up on. But
does it make
shame.
A difference, Catherine, in how you view his potential to reach a slam final and eventually win one?
No, not really, because he was always going to win a title. He was always going to win one, you know, barring disaster. He ought to be an ATP title winner. This doesn't change for me my feelings about his ability or potential. I'm still a little unsure on what that is. I certainly am not thinking Grand Slam champion at this stage.
Do you think finalist?
Maybe. I mean, that's only one step further than he's already been. There's no doubt there is going to be a period in tennis when there will be opportunities, you know, when there will not be a stranglehold. There will be very good players around, but there will not be a stranglehold, and it's about who capitalizes. You know, you look at that post Sampras, pre Federer era, there's going to be a patch like that. I don't know how long it'll last, but he needs to get himself in the position to be one of the guys to capitalize, because I don't think anyone's talking about him as to be, you know, the next number one, the next dominating force, the next, you know, person to take over from the big four, anything like that. I mean, stranger things have happened, but that still feels, you know, a bridge too far. But could he be the guy that makes the absolute most of a slice of luck and a good dose of talent? He could be that guy. He could be that guy.
77% of our voters in pole vault reckon that he will not win a Grand Slam title, but 37% of the total also think he will reach a final. So there we are. I'd go with that group.
I mean, it's a little bit British cockeyed to be asking that question, isn't it? On a weekend when, let's be really honest, there were two other title winners that are both probably in the non-British biased tennis watcher's eye more likely to
Karen Khachanov's one of them, isn't he? Karen Khachanov won Moscow, and it's his third title, correcting myself, because I thought it was his first. Terrible for me. But it was his third title. It beat Adrian Manarino 6-2, 6-2. So you'd put Khachanov ahead of Edmund in terms of likelihood of winning a slam?
Not by much, but yes. That performance against Nadal at the US Open that way he was just able to bully Rafael Nadal, that took my breath away. I know he didn't win it, but it really took my breath away. So, I mean, I'd put Tsitsipas miles ahead of either of them.
Would you?
Yeah, I would, yeah. He's the real deal. He's Ooh. The real deal. Incidentally, he won the title in Stockholm. That's yeah. why we're talking about him.
His first title.
Gorbis in the final, straight sets, 4-4.
Gorbis, yeah, 6-4, yeah.
6-4. Well, Tsitsipas was only winning his first ATP tour-level match just over a year ago. So to sort of, yeah,
and only 20.
We mentally readjust to a new status quo very quickly in tennis. Very, very quickly. And the status quo now is that Tsitsipas is a top 20 player and a future Grand Slam champion. And so I think a lot of people went, oh, his first ATP title. But, you know, 16 in the world, highest ever ranked male player in the world under the age of 21. He's the highest ranked male player in the world. He not ever, obviously. He's the highest ranked. Can you tell I'm reading notes? At 16, he's the highest ranked male player in the world currently under the age of 21.
I mean,
he's the first ever Greek to win an ATP title.
Can I tell you're reading notes?
Greek
no, I can't, because
I
if you
say.
Were, you'd be getting it right. Anyway, it's right
touché,
there.
Touché. He's been congratulated by the Greek Prime Minister.
Yeah, nice, you got
it?
That bit right. Definitely the Greek Prime Minister.
Interesting lack of, you know, response on Twitter from Nick Kyrgios and Tanasi Kokkinakis.
Hmm. Yes. They've won titles, haven't they? No, I mean, Kyrgios has won a title, but Kokkinakis
not for not for a while, David.
Not for a while. For and a he while. Pulled out of Moscow, hurt again. Hopefully, he gets better.
Yeah, we're soon. Not going to talk about him.
No. All right. That's that done. What else has happened?
Crikey, what else has happened? Well, we've had events on the women's side in Luxembourg and Moscow. Obviously, this sort of situation, which most people agree is slightly crazy, where you've got regular tour-level events that count towards WTA finals ranking points taking place right up until the eve of the WTA finals, you know, which was highlighted, the ridiculousness of which was highlighted most starkly a couple of years ago when Svetlana Kuznetsova won Moscow and ousted Joe Konter from the WTA finals field after Joe Konter had featured in the draw and all the publicity therein. But anyway, nothing of that nature this time. Daria Kazatkina, though, was a Russian that won in Moscow, beat Ons Jabeur in the final. She's a great watch. We've talked a lot about what a great watch we find Daria Kazatkina to be. But Ons Jabeur is she's very watchable.
I didn't realise.
Isn't she?
I honestly, I've partially watched matches of hers without really taking any notice, and I feel really quite embarrassed to say that, but I think that does happen, particularly when you're at Grand Slams. You just sort of, matches just kind of go on in your subconscious without you really taking them in, unless in our case you're covering them as a commentator. And I think I commentated on three of her matches in Moscow, Jabeur, and she qualified for the tournament twice, having lost the first set 6-1, including against Harriet Dart of the UK, who she then ended up beating 7-6 in the third. That was just qualifying. Then she went and absolutely smashed through Ekaterina Makarova 6-2, 6-1, and at the end of the match, she was carrying on to the next point, and then the umpire said, no, it's game, set and match, you've won. And she was just so in the moment, she didn't even realise she'd won the match. Then she beat Sloane Stephens, who, I got to be honest, did not give her best effort, in my opinion. I think she mentally was completely on the plane already. She'd already found out she was qualifying for Singapore. And we've seen today that in her win over Naomi Osaka, just how well Sloane Stephens is capable of playing. Not that we needed reminding, but she wasn't there mentally. And Jabeur just took her down big time, and she was absolutely fantastic. If you haven't seen Jabeur play, she's not tall, she's strong, she's incredibly dexterous with her hands, and she plays all sorts of angles and touches, and she goes to the net and she plays trick shots. There were through the leg shots, there were jump double-handed backhands cross court. It was like watching Kasatkina playing in a mirror. And as a match, she led Kasatkina 6-2, 4-1, and it looked as though Jibbo was going to get the title. And then Kasatkina got one of the great on-court coaching sessions I've ever seen from Philip DeHaze, and it was not the first time either. Throughout the week, he is an incredible coach at those on-court deliveries. And for the second time in a week, he did the same against Elise Cornet when she was looking as though she's about to go out of the tournament, and he just came on and just delivered these speeches to her, and she just got up out of her chair like a different woman. Did you see those?
I did, yeah. It was the Cornet one where he was encouraging her to be like a Russian wall. He sort of covered the, you know, the emotional, psychological and the tactical all in one pretty profound, inspiring little package. And he did it in a really... He didn't just sit down or sort of... I don't know, so many of them in so many different ways, sort of the body language makes me uncomfortable, either a hand on the knee or something about the way they're sort of quite literally talking down to them sometimes just makes me feel a touch uncomfortable. But everything about their dynamic was just really nice, you know, obviously just works. I mean, there is still something just in principle about us giving so much credit to a male coach for a female's performance. You know, I felt the same, even though I was doing it as well, and it's right to do it. You know, I felt the same at the French Open when, you know, Darren Cahill was almost as talked about as Simona Halep, and he is a brilliant coach, and a lot of her success can be attributed to him. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. It just, in principle, makes me uncomfortable, and I don't think I will ever, I mean, long story short, I wish there were more female coaches. I mean, that's the fundamental problem, that it's, on the women's tour, it is always, almost exclusively always, a man telling a woman what to do. And I wish there were more women doing it, so it didn't seem such a gendered issue, because it oughtn't to be a gendered issue, it should just be a coach telling a player what to do. But because of the way it is with coaching anyway, but I'm not wanting to say that Philippe DeHaze doesn't deserve a lot of credit, because I want a Philippe DeHaze in my corner sometimes just to get through the day.
You got one. Yeah. You're talking to him.
You've got to wake up from this nap, Catherine. You've got to do it.
Yeah, okay. I don't say that because I'm too scared, frankly. but no, he's an impressive bloke in the way he delivers those. And look, you know, I take the point about it would be nice to just see the genders equaled up, and also the sheer fact that it only happens on the women's tour is part of that problem, because you don't get a reverse. But as a, I don't think I've seen.
Well, and if you did get a reverse, it wouldn't be gendered either, because it would be a man telling a man what to do.
Well, on
almost exclusively.
Almost exclusively, yeah. Not 100%, but almost.
Well,
we've seen Maresma. We've seen, what's his name? Dennis Istomin. His coach was his mum, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yeah. So you're giving me one current example.
No, I'm not going to give you many, but I'm not going to say it's exclusive when it's not.
You're giving me one.
Yeah, I've given you two.
I didn't say exclusive, I said almost.
I've just given you two.
And you hummed and hawed about it.
I've given you two examples.
No, one current example.
Yeah, okay, one current example, and I've given you one other one as well. Anyway.
No, current examples.
Oh, crikey.
Not in the mood for this, David.
No, me either. So, anyway, Philippe DeHaze was the most stark example of changing the course of a match that I've ever seen from an on-court coaching position, and he did it twice in a week. So,
the most stark example. Wow.
Give me a bigger one.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm not doubting it. I just hadn't, you know, fully assessed it in comparative terms.
6-2, 4-1.
Yeah, no,
she's
losing. you could very well be right.
I can't think of anything else where somebody has been 6-2, 4-1 down and has taken such a turn like that when a coach has come on to actually going and winning the title as a result of it, or after it anyway.
Yeah, I hope he's on a commission, a prize money bonus deal of some sort. She's got the first alternate spot in Singapore for her troubles.
Yeah,
in Moscow.
She has, although, I mean, I'm trying to think of examples in the past where the alternate in the WTA finals has ended up playing. I can't think of many. I mean, I can think of quite a few in the ATP finals, but...
Yeah, there's an awful lot fewer in the WTA. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there will be ones.
Maybe it's because the event is that much earlier in the year. I mean, it's 22nd of October, and you've still got another 3 weeks of tennis before the ATP finals gets underway.
And they play best of three at Slams.
Hmm.
Not that I'm supporting any revision. You know, let's not get into that.
Ben is going to be flying over and demanding to come on the podcast to say, yes, you make my point. Anyway.
We can't open all the cans of worms in one episode. What do you want to do next, David? Do you want to do on-court coaching or do you want to do Singapore?
Just a quick word for Jo Konta.
I've sort of accidentally done segues onto both of those things. Oh, Jo Konta.
Let's give her a quick mention because she's not had that many reasons to celebrate this year and she ended up with a semi-final, so that helps.
Yeah, again, sort of similar to Kyle, really. You'd fear for her mentally over the off-season if she'd had another bad week and just ended on a bum note and had sort of only poor memories, really, of 2018, especially given that she went into Moscow trialling a new coaching relationship. She's got something positive to take with her into the off-season. So we will see. We will see. Hey, she's going to have pretty much nothing to defend in 2019, is she? I mean, not nothing, but relative to where she's been. So mentally, it's going to be more like where she was in 2019. So we'll see.
Yeah, I still think there's something still not quite right, though, because, I know, she played quite well in that semi against Kasatkina and got beaten 6-4, 6-3.
Yeah, because Kasatkina's really clever and Jo Konta is easy to work out.
Yes, but I still think that Konta of a year and a half ago wins that match. There's something, there's a bit more conviction about her ground strikes back then, but still.
Well, Konta of a year and a half ago had Wim Fissette in her corner. Angelique Kerber of 2 weeks ago had Wim Fissette in her corner. Is he the sort of, is he the one-year wonder?
Well, it is a quite stark track record that he's got, isn't it, of having really significant results with a player, whether due to him or not. I mean, that's the other thing with all these things. You don't know how much a coach has got to do with it. We've just touched on that, really. But certainly, their results have coincided with his presence. Some serious results. And Kerber's had a great year, really good year. And that decision to stop the collaboration without that many bits of information given, just a different view regarding the future. And that's kind of the same as we heard about him and Konta at the time. And there are others too. I mean, he was with Halep for a while. He was with Lezicki for a while, you know.
Azarenka.
And it didn't end up leading to
the timing's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the finals.
Yeah, really bizarre timing. I can't really explain that.
Nobody seems to be able to shed any light either. You know,
I mean, look, there were rumours when Konta split up with Fissette that, you know, there was financial disagreement, you know, renegotiation of a contract and they couldn't come to a financial agreement. I never heard any significant substantiation of that. The fact that the situation of splitting up after a relatively short period was not unique to Konta. I mean, it does suggest that there's something. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he's just the Mourinho of tennis. Although
that'd be 3 years.
Although, if you're making that, exactly. But you know, a sort of limited period, high impact, extricate yourself quickly. Try not to rubbish your whole career track record with a a botched stint at Man United.
So who's going to be his Man United?
Who will be his Man U? Well, I mean, maybe...
Who's the Man United of women's tennis?
Oh.
Is it Garbine
Muguruza? Oh, that's a good one. Someone... Oh, it might be. It might be. But I don't think Sam Sumic's going anywhere anytime soon, is he?
Well, you say that, but I mean, she's not even reached the WTA finals this year.
But that's, you know, she's been off the rails for a long time, and there never seems to be any questioning of him, even though I put those two in the category of a dynamic when I see the on-court coaching that frequently makes me uncomfortable.
In the past, though, the results were there. I mean, the previous 2 years,
yeah,
she did qualify,
she was
and she won the slam.
By Conchita Martinez when she won Wimbledon. Sam Sumic was off having a baby back home, and it was Martinez that got the ousting. I don't understand any of it. And again, it's another one that we've never really... It's not like information's leaked out or anything. And never really got to the bottom of Martinez being ousted there. Who is Fassett going to go for next? Or who is going to go for Fassett next?
I don't know. I mean, I'm still thinking Garbine Muguruza, maybe. But we'll see.
Who is coachless at the moment?
Is it Azarenka?
Yeah, but he's been there, done that.
Yeah, well, that happens. Remember Ivan Lendl and old Andy Murray?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I wait with bated breath. I wait with bated breath. That's going to be an interesting one. He's, you know, and is he a big enough? Is he going through the Rolodex and putting in calls, or is he sat by the phone waiting to be called? What do you think?
That's a very good question. I don't know. A lot of this goes through agents as well. So,
yeah.
Don't know. It's going to be intriguing. We'll watch the space and listen to our podcast, and we will let you know when we hear about it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Should we talk about Patrick Mouratoglou and what he's been saying?
While we're on the subject of coaches. How to sum up what Patrick Mouratoglou has been saying. He has, David, he's been speaking to the media. Does that surprise you?
Really?
He's been making his views known.
When Serena Williams hasn't got a tournament at the moment.
Yeah, he's the gift that keeps on giving. Patrick Mouratoglou...
Actually, tweeted, didn't he?
Seemingly unsolicited. I don't know whether it was prompted by something, but he put out a statement on Twitter entitled "The Status of Coaching Needs Reforming." Broken down into bullet points, he says coaching deserves to be recognised and valued. It's a vital component of a sporting performance. Da, da, da. Banning it almost makes it look as if it needs to be hidden, as if it's shameful. Da, da, da. Because tennis is the only sport where coaching isn't front and centre. We'll come back to that one in a moment, Patrick. Third bullet point, because on-court coaching helps increase the quality of the sporting show and resolves a lot of the issues our sport is facing, can attract new people to tennis, create engagement on social media. Final argument in favour of allowing mid-match coaching, because it's time to, quote, stop the hypocrisy surrounding coaching. It is a very basic truth that the vast majority of tennis coaches are actually coaching on-court, despite the rules and despite the fact that Serena says... still says he weren't coaching me on court during the US Open final. Yeah. What do you think, David?
Well, my first immediate reaction to it was to just point out the comical irony of the fact that it would appear Serena Williams never wants him to come on and coach her, because it certainly never happened, as far as I can remember. Unless anybody can put me right on that, he has never taken to the court to deliver on-court coaching on the WTA circuit, which to my understanding would mean that she doesn't ask him to come on. Now, Simon Camber's, a colleague of ours, did an interview with Patrick a while back in which Patrick was quoted as saying that Serena has asked him to come on, I take that to mean privately, i.e. before a match she said that she'd like it, and he said that he prefers her to work things out on her own, pretty much, which makes it all very confusing as to put this out. I mean, the actual things he said, many of them I kind of agree with. I do think that the current situation is unsatisfactory, and that coaching does go on. It'd be just nice to have a clear rule across the sport whereby we know exactly what to expect and what's going on. I do think we've talked about on-court coaching generally, that you and I think are basically in favour of a form of it, whether it's headset coaching or actually on-court coaching, putting aside all the issues that we've talked about of man dishing out instructions to women and the look that has and all that sort of thing. There is an element to on-court coaching that is interesting. So there are a lot of things that I actually think he makes a valid point about it. I think it's just that it's him who's made these points, and he's made them just after one of the biggest furores that we've ever had in a Grand Slam final as a direct result of his coaching from the sidelines. So the timing of it is surprising to me, really. But I do think it's, I mean, at the same time, do I want people to just not say what they think? Well, I do kind of want them to say what they think. So fair enough in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, to deal with his points one by one, I think coaching in tennis is recognised and valued. I agree that it's a vital component of the sport and shouldn't be hidden, but I don't think it is. You know, I refer to what I was saying earlier about the fact that, you know, there was an element of the quantity of credit that was given to Darren Cahill, etc., that made me uncomfortable just because of how gendered it felt. I don't agree that coaching is undervalued in tennis. I really don't. I mean,
no, I don't
as people that cover the sport and lead discussions in the sport and debate and all the rest of it, I really feel like I spend a lot of time talking about coaching relationships and dynamics and breakups.
I think we do overdo it a bit, to be honest.
Yeah, because it's such a fruitful, it's a rich seam of conversation often. I agree. I think if anything, it's a little bit overdone. And just look at what, I mean, okay, a lot of it's down to who he's been coaching, but look at what Patrick's got from being Serena's coach. You know, he's got his own show on Eurosport. He didn't have that before he was a Serena Williams coach. You know, with all due respect to him, he didn't suddenly become a good coach when he teamed up with Serena. But he certainly wasn't a guy that was going to get his own show called The Coach. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I don't agree with him on that. I certainly don't agree with him, and I don't think statistics would either that tennis is the only sport where coaching isn't front and centre.
I'm not so sure that I can think of many sports. I can't think. Tell me a sport where there isn't coaching involved in
Well, what does he mean? I think he means sort of prominence in terms of public awareness there, though. Coaching.
I took it to mean that you can't consult a coach during a match.
I took it to mean sort of, you know, the sort of a continuation of the previous point about how recognised and valued it is from the outside.
Mm. No, that's not what I read it as. I mean, because I think we're reading an abridged version here that Matt has put together for us. But I think actually he definitely makes the point that, you know, in sports like boxing and all that sort of thing, you can talk to your coach at the end of every single round. That is definitely a significant argument.
Yeah, and I think that's a very strong example in favour of on-court coaching, because absolutely, I've never heard any suggestion. You've watched a lot more boxing in your time than I have, David, but I've never heard any suggestion that element of, you know, being able to consult your coach during the timeout, etc., detracts from the gladiatorial element, the one-on-one heat of battle, anything like that. I've never heard anyone suggest that detracts from all the things we love about boxing.
Here it is, Catherine. Actually, the point is entitled "Because Tennis is the Only Sport Where Coaching Isn't Front and Centre." And he says, "I've never understood why tennis is just about the only sport in which coaching during matches is not allowed. You see it all the time in team sports. Football coaches instruct their players from the sidelines. They take advantage from halftime to adjust their teams or systems. Basketball coaches can call timeouts several times during a game, and you can also see it in individual sports. Boxers receive a constant stream of advice from their corners. Cyclists on the road have radio contact with teams. Golfers have got their caddies. Tennis may become the last sport to give coaching the attention it deserves, but it's better late than never if they end up having on-court coaching across the board."
I don't disagree with him, but then he sort of conflates the issue there in his last point by saying attention it deserves.
Yeah, I agree with you about that. I think it does get the attention it deserves. It's just that why wouldn't you allow it like the other sports do?
I firmly agree with point number three that it done properly, and we've made the points in the past about the desperate need for translation. I find that increasingly farcical the more and more I see of it. The fact that quite often we're sitting there and probably, you know, 1% of the viewership and none of the commentary team can understand what's going on, which when a large justification for something existing is the enhancement of the experience for the viewer, if a lot of the time that is just completely lost because it's being spoken in a language that few viewers can understand, that is a farcical situation. But done the right way, I agree in principle with that it's an added extra for the viewer and for the broadcaster.
It's going to be very interesting to see which way they end up going with all this in terms of whether they are able to get some sort of a consensus about it all. Because, I mean, you know, the WTA Tour now has been running this trial, in inverted commas, for 9 years. The
other thing worth pointing out is that there's, again, a conflation of on-court coaching and mid-match coaching. On the WTA, a player is allowed to bring their coach on-court once per set, but that doesn't mean it's a free-for-all for coaching from the box the rest of the time.
Or Davis Cup style. That's the other one that he appears to like, and there are many that do. Brad Gilbert's a big fan of on-court coaching. It's fascinating. There's so many that are absolutely dead against it, ex-players. Virtually every ex-player I speak to
and
is against
Chris Clary, our very esteemed colleague, who I so rarely disagree with on anything, is vehemently opposed to it, isn't he?
Mm. Oh, if Chris is against
it, then I know.
I might have to change my mind.
I know.
Should we talk about something we can agree on? What about Wimbledon 12-all tie breaks in the final set?
Yeah, I mean, it's not much of a discussion point, really, is it? Because I think everybody's just gone, yep, that makes sense, great.
John Isner rule.
You know, it's just.
Would you have changed the number at which it comes in? Because I know some people feel that it should have been a 6-all.
Yeah, I love a fifth set tiebreak. Again, this is a debate that we've had. I think it's a brilliant way to end a match. I'm not uncomfortable with it at 12-all. That's fine. I don't feel strongly enough about it to make any kind of hoo-ha. But I would like it to be consistent across the slams, ideally. And I'd be cool with it all being US Open style, six
I'd have been
in the fifth,
quite
but, you know,
tempted to go 9-all personally. and
but
that,
isn't this all just getting a bit arbitrary?
Yeah.
You're just plucking numbers from the sky. Why not 11 all?
No, well, I like 9 all, so, you know. But no, it's okay. It's fine because at least it stops the absurdity that we saw at Wimbledon this year where Kevin Anderson, bless him, could barely walk the day he came out for the Wimbledon final after 26-24 and obviously 70-68 for Isner. I mean, come on.
And also pertinently, that wasn't a brilliant match.
Well, it got progressively worse.
It got progressively worse, exactly. So for people making the argument that it, you know, the drama and the quality, maybe not always the quality, but the drama, et cetera, the viewing experience just increases as the final set goes on. No. Everyone was ready for that match to end.
You need to know there is a full stop. There is a finish line. Even if it is still epically long and it's starting to get worse, you could, at least if you can see that finish line, I think players can just sort of accept it more. It's that never-ending feel. I think that they end up just protecting their games and their bodies. They don't play proper tennis. Anyway, I think we're in
agreement. I mean, we are talking about for a rule change that's caused such a massive stir. I mean, there have only been 14 singles matches of Wimbledon that have reached 12 all in the last 18 years.
Wow.
So it's 0.29% of all matches, singles matches. So, yeah, in terms of rule changes and the impact on the sport, we're talking about a footnote here.
Mm.
Not okay. For Kevin Anderson, we're not. But, yeah.
What's going on in Singapore?
Singapore were 2 days in. It's been good. Today was good, wasn't it?
Stevens, you started off with a moan about the court speed. What was all that about?
It's too slow. It's too slow, David.
Meaning what?
I find it a frustrating watch. I can't quite put my finger on, you know, because slow doesn't necessarily equal bad. I'm not saying that. There's just something, don't know, I find myself sort of just in a state of just frustration.
Do you know what? I agree with you. I tell you, here's the problem.
Can you help me express it in ways that aren't just making
noises? I would say I had
help
the same
me.
Problem at the US Open this year where Jim Courier said that the USTA had specifically gone out and slowed it down to try to help American players. The result you got...
I believe that it was to help American players, but anyway.
The result that you ended up getting was that Juan Martín Del Potro in the final, admittedly against one of the greatest movers the sport has ever seen, and somebody who can just put the ball on a dime on the baseline time after time, Juan Martín Del Potro was struggling to hit winners with enough regularity against Novak Djokovic on a hard court. And that should not happen, in my view. If Del Potro hits his straps and is really leveling the ball, he should be able to hit winners against anybody. And we saw today Naomi Osaka against Sloane Stephens. And again, Stephens is just an incredible defender. I mean, she's got the full package. She can defend and attack. But Osaka, when she's on, she just knocks holes through people. And it just felt like she couldn't hit enough winners to me.
Yeah, it just somehow feels unfair, doesn't it? That there are shots that instinctively should be winners, even against the best movers in the world. And when they're not, you just feel like, oh, well, I mean, if that's how I feel, then the likes of Naomi Osaka, you know, shot maker style of players should, I mean, I can only imagine how frustrated she was. And there was a period during that match when she really did seem to be at a complete loss, didn't she? She did very well to take the second set, actually. Her serve was keeping her in it for a lot of the match. Lost the third 6-1. Kiki Bertens fought back from a 6-1 first set defeat to beat Angelique Kerber 6-3, 6-4. Yeah, and I thought the court speed might suit Kerber a bit, but yeah, I mean, judging on the basis of the court speed, Sloane Stephens should win this tournament, I think.
Yeah, I think that's quite a good chat, actually, because she has that ability to do both. You know, she can put the acceleration in, but she can also just defend so well and use those angles and just drag players off the court. I mean, what a player
she is. And she's got the patience as well. She's got the patience. Yeah.
But, do you know, when we were watching that, yeah, when that match was on, Stevens against Naomi Osaka, Martina Navratilova was commentating on it here, and I've become, probably started to lean towards more thinking, I'm not so sure about this round robin, because I don't like doing the sums when I'm watching tennis matches. It's a bit like watching football and seeing away goals. I don't like to think, oh, well, what does that mean to the rest of the standings and that sort of thing. Same time, watching Osaka today, the thought that that's not her last match, even though you lose that feeling of jeopardy, which I really value in the sport, I do like the thought that I am going to get to see Naomi Osaka again.
I think the countless Japanese journalists that have made the trip to Singapore feel the same. Apparently, it's just Piotr Wozniacki came into, I think they've been doing press conferences with the coaches today, and Piotr Wozniacki came into press, and he was visibly taken aback, apparently, by the just how many Japanese journalists there were. And he said he greeted the room by saying, "Hello, Japan." So that would be a disappointing short trip for them all if that were Osaka over and out. So,
what do you think about it?
Yeah, I know. Some people, I mean, Chris Bradnam, for one, who's out there commentating, I know he feels really strongly opposed and is making his views very known on it. I to and fro. I think after last year's, I don't know. I it feels like there are more good round robin matches at the WTA finals, certainly recently, than there have been at the ATP finals. We've had a couple of disappointing years of round robins in the ATP finals, I think. Certainly last year it was disappointing, wasn't it?
I can't remember them last year. I remember 2 or 3 years ago when virtually every match had a 6-1 set in it, and they were all straight sets. Everybody was just exhausted. But I don't... Getting back to this court speed thing, just generally, I don't get why tournaments are not just deliberately quickening these courts. I mean, why wouldn't
Maybe they will now. Yeah, I know. I think Martina Navratilova was talking about it a lot in commentary today, wasn't she? And certainly, I suspect the USTA were quite taken aback by the response they got to the court speed at the US Open this year. And maybe they didn't intend for it to be as big a difference as it ended up. But the whole thing's such a precise science that you'd think, you know, how could they possibly be surprised by the end result? But yeah, I mean, if we were ruling tennis, David, we'd change it in a flash, wouldn't we?
Well, you,
if
yeah.
only.
But I mean,
do you know what I've done, David?
What?
I've held up this chat just long enough that we don't really have time to do any tennis jokes.
Oh, chokes or jokes? Both.
Either. I'll tell you what. You've got a minute and a half. You can divide that between chokes and jokes, however you like.
Okay. I'll tell you what. What I'm going to do is, because it's only a minute and a half and I feel like tennis chokes, C-H-O-K-E-S, needs to get its proper dues, I'm going to go with jokes, right? So at Tennis Podcast, I asked you for your tennis jokes just because I misunderstood Catherine.
I really hoped you'd go with chokes.
Well, too bad. You give me the opportunity and I'm going to take
there
it.
There are no good tennis jokes.
There are. There are some really good ones.
Is not a joke.
Jim Boyle says, what time does Sean Connery arrive at Wimbledon?
Tennis.
Yeah. Anderson says, why are fish never good tennis players?
Don't know.
They don't like getting close to the net. Amy says, why should you never fall in love with a tennis player?
Because love means nothing.
Correct. I mean, what is this? Mastermind. Used to be a runner says, nobody likes my reserve at the tennis club. It keeps getting returned.
Mm.
So there we
if
have
any,
it.
Okay.
Hashtag tennis jokes.
Write to us at Tennis Podcast and let us, if there's anyone out there that laughed out loud at any one of those jokes.
Have you
during
got
this podcast? And any one of any single one of them, and I will stand corrected.
Have you got any tennis jokes, Catherine?
No, because there aren't any funny tennis jokes. All I could think of was I remember one year at the Albert Hall, Tim Henman opened. The players always get sent fan mail, so just addressed, you know, Tim Henman, Royal Albert Hall. He had a letter from a fan just sort of politely saying, Tim, just occurred to me the other day and I felt I should pass it on. You really should open a fish and chip shop called Chip and Charge. I mean, it's still not funny.
I mean, that wouldn't just, even get into hashtag tennis jokes. That is appalling. Yeah,
this is not a segment that will be returning.
Oh, God, I'm closing it down after that. That is awful.
Well, it's not my joke.
Well, you've just told it. You just put it on air.
Yeah, well, they've all been rubbish. They've all been rubbish. A pun is not, pun does not equal joke.
Oh,
we will do tennis jokes another time. They're never going out of date, are they?
No.
Just one other tiny bit. We won't dedicate more than a few seconds to this, David. But Renee Stalford, the Swiss journalist, very esteemed Swiss journalist, has had some time with Roger Federer this week. They've talked about all sorts of things. Federer told him that he had a hand injury. He injured his hand before Wimbledon and that was affecting him, for about a three-month period afterwards, including during the defeat to Kevin Anderson. And a lot of people pointing out this isn't the first time that after the fact Federer has said, oh, actually, I was a little bit injured. And given how much time, rightly, I believe, we spend singing Roger Federer's praises, because in many millions of respects, he's marvellous. We, you know, should we just highlight the fact that that's not, you know, technically it's all sort of against the sporting code, isn't it?
It's one of those, though, isn't it? You know, we want players to be honest and then we rip them if they're not. But I do feel that, you know, he made quite a big thing of the fact that he'd come into the US Open this year and this time he was fit and ready to go, you know, whereas last year he wasn't. And so, yeah, this is the first we've heard of it, really. Yeah, I'm not too keen on it, but I have to say at the same time, Catherine, it kind of would add up a bit. I mean, his forehand was all over the...
It's been awful summer, hasn't it? Or was awful
against
summer,
Kevin Anderson at Wimbledon and then various other places. He couldn't put it in the court.
Yeah, he could for the first two sets, though.
Yeah, but then it started hurting.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know.
Well, yeah. Anyway, just felt like it should get a little mention. And we've done that. Stan Wawrinka is out of the rest of the season with a back
injury. Go on, rest up, Stan.
That's a bit of a bum note to end on.
Rest up. 2019's coming.
2019 is a coming. That's it, David. That's all I've got.
Tennis chokes
apart,
next
apart
week.
Apart from tennis chokes, which deserves more time.
Yeah.
You've got an extra week to perform another... to get another entry into the tennis chokes competition. Oh.
I'm playing again on Thursday. It's gonna,
right then.
Oh dear, I'm stressed.
That's 4 days away. Right then, we've been the Tennis Podcast, David. Brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with our executive producers, Melanie Bowes, Triple S, TennisBalls.com, with La Manga Club. Charlie the Ferret. He said, we've not heard much from Charlie recently, have we? We can only assume he's in fine health and scurrying around, having too great a time to contact us. And we'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.